One of the good stories I like to always tell is in August of 67 on 4 to 12, I was a three-shift welder, and 4 to 12 was our favorite shift for watching, and it was 10:20, 10:30, and I was in the welding shop this night, and I was welding, and we have an interplant phone, which is 515. The plate shop was 505, and my friend Jimmy Tomasini was ringing the phone off the wall. I guess there was five or six of us back at the plate shop. He was in the welding shop. No, I was in the welding shop. He was in the plate shop. And he said, "Don," he said, "did you look out the front and see this UFO? And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, it did a double circle around the stack." He said, "I'm sure it's a UFO. A plane would never come in the grounds. It'd be against the law." And he says, "You better run to the front door. Just leave the phone off the hook and see if you can see it." I run to the front door, which was a couple of hundred feet, and I looked, over toward the dry, just in time to see this thing hovering over near the dry. So I run back to the phone, and I said, "Jimmy, I'm going to run right over to the plate shop right now, where you are." And he said, "Oh, good, good." He says, "It's definitely UFO, because I've lost track of it." And where he was in the plate shop, he could no longer see it from where I could see it out the back door. So I run across the road, put my helmet and everything down, my gear, got over to the plate shop where there was at least eight welders. He was one of them that was working overtime that night, and plus our own gang of 10 welders, and plus eight plate workers, because some converter hoods and some other things had collapsed, the number one and two converter, and they had emergency jobs rebuilding to get these converters back into operation. So this is quite all interesting. So we all run out the back, everybody's all excited. "Hey, come on, welders, Maniego and Dubois and Kelly and everybody that was in there, we're calling them all. Come on to the back door and come and see what's over the dry." So we angle our lookout and we go out in the back tracks, and we're all out the back door. Some guys are smoking, some aren't. And we're all looking, and it's just hovering there over the dry. And this got us quite excited. Then it started to approach our shop. So we were waiting, and it's coming down, coming down. It's not, it's barely moving, like not even 30 miles an hour, maybe 10, 15, just coming down. We say, "My God, this thing is so low. You know, we think it's going to get caught in the hydro lines, because we've got all these electric poles up for the electric trains." And we think, and we say, "Well, it isn't that low. It must be 10 feet. It must be missing the post by 10 feet. Well, you wouldn't have an airplane flying over darkness at 10, 15 feet over hydro poles with high current line. It's coming, and it's off to our left. And it's a gorgeous sight. Here's a little red light on the front and a green light, you know. And the red light is pulsating. The green light is on steady. We can't tell the back from the front of this craft, because we can see it's an oval shape. We're not directly underneath it, but we're almost at an angle. So we watch it as it goes by. Now it's facing directly east as it passes our eyesight from the back door, and the CIL building is about 800, 900 feet past the plate shop. We glance over straight east. We say, "Oh my God, it's going to bump right into the building." All of us, we're all watching this with great delight, and it eases right up, just beautiful in banks, just as if it's got its radar set for buildings and obtrusion. It just lifts automatically, just clears the CIL stainless steel stacks for vents. It just goes right over them at a beautiful angle, and then veers up. I personally did not see it do the double take around the stack. This was earlier in the evening, and I didn't see it go over the concentrator, because we can't see the concentrator. The concentrator, apparently, when it went over it, there was about 15 witnesses out there that were out in the backyard scraping down old Denver cell parts and everything. We found this out the next day. They had witnessed it going over there. Number 3 power station is about 1,000 feet before number 1 dry, where I changed every day. And when it went over the power station, all the knives broke open. And these were the main feed lines from number 1 power station to the concentrator. The concentrator kicked out at 10:30 that night, causing a gigantic flood. All blacked out in that area, which we didn't know at that time had happened. So anyway, Sergeant Wayman, meanwhile, after seeing all this and the thing flying away at an amazing, you know, just a blip light going up, 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 and then it became a star and then it was gone. I'm on the phone phoning the 969, the radar, telling them just what's happened. And then they start asking questions. "What condition is the sky? Or did you see this by yourself, sir?" I said, "Oh, no." I said, "There's 18 or 20 of us here at least that were all watching it at the same time. We're all tradespeople." That impressed him. Couldn't be all drunk at work, in case that's what he was implying. "Have you been drinking tonight?" "I'm a welder. My age is 30-some years old, blah, blah. I'm a first-class welder." Told him all this, and he said, "Okay." So he took down all the all the detail, and he said, you'll be hearing from us about that. Hung up. Meanwhile, Sergeant Wayman, he's passed away since then. He died about 8 years, 9 years later than this date. He come running over all out of breath, and he said, hey, you guys, did you see? He says, I was standing at the, he's security, eh? He's standing at the front gate. He said, did you see that thing come over? He says, I was at the front gate of the dry. He says, just standing there and having a smoke. He said, big as life. He says, I never believed in these things. He said, a big circle thing, he says, and a big bottom. He says, what a fantastic sight, and not even a hum out of it, you know, just like a ghost moving along. And he says, not only that, he says, but I seen it when it went over the transformer house. And he said, all these flashes as all the knives kicked out. He said, I seen that too. He says, they must be going to have trouble tonight someplace. He didn't know that it was connected to the concentrator. So we're all talking to Sergeant Wayman, and I said, I phoned the radar base. He was excited. We're excited. None of us did anything the rest of the night except sit down and talk about what we had just witnessed. And the radar base, of course, they got in touch with me the following day. They phoned me at home, knowing that I had made a few other reports from before this time in this same year. They knew who Don Campbell was. So, to make a long story short, the next day we found out there was about 15 witnesses at the concentrator. The people near the power station, you're not allowed to go in, except the two operators. They didn't see the knives actually opening up, but the two electricians on duty had to unlock the gates, go in there, and push one knife in at a time, and by walkie-talkies to the remote station, and say, okay, power's on number one, power's on number two. You don't push all the knives in too rapidly, because you can get a burnout, because all the power is in the on modes of the concentrator. They didn't have automatic kickoffs. So you had to put in phase one, wait a minute, then phase two, phase three. So they were very careful. They'd watch their voltage come up, you know, kick in the lines. So I think there was five kick-in switches or six that had all kicked out. You just don't slam them all back in to get power, because you'd get a power surge and something would burn out. So each phase controls a certain part of the concentrator. I didn't know this at the time, but talking to electricians, I found out. So they kicked them all back in. And again, there's the next day that the official reason, or the reason that the power went out in the log book of the superintendent at that time was logged in their book. You know, because they have to report this to New York. When they have a shutdown, it costs $20,000-$30,000 in lost production. It has to be noted in a log book, the superintendent. He was not on duty that night, but when he came on duty the next day, he was a steady day man. He was told all the circumstances. So the official reason for the power outage at 10:30 that evening for 15 minutes before they got everything kicked back in and the loss of production was an unidentified flying object over the Coppercliff complex doing a double circle around the middle stack, then over the concentrator, and then over the dry, and then over the back of the plate shop with 18-20 witnesses, over the CIL building, disappearing in a northeasterly direction. And as told by Don Campbell, who had phoned the radar, and they confirmed that it sped away at 22,000 miles an hour from a cruising speed of 10-15 miles an hour in the yard, which it was just poking, and then when it angled up and left, it just became a star. And then if you looked up, that's what you think it was, just a little white star. This is one of my favorite stories because so many people looked at it, and the welders that used to kid me and say, there's UFO Don, the guy that goes out at night with different people and sees UFOs, and when they all seen it and spread it to all the other 50, 60, 70 welders, there was no more kidding around about UFO Don anymore, because there was 18, 20 people, all with eyes like me, looking up at an object with a red and green light and witnessing for their first time in their life a genuine UFO, not a Piper Cub or a Cessna, flying 10, 15 feet over the company property at 10:30 at night, and causing an outage of electrical power and everything, and documented by the superintendent. Everybody was excited. Then from then on, when I used to go out on my excursions, two, three, four people would want to come out with me. And I used to just sort of put most of them off, except my favorite friend, who believed me right from the start, which was Jimmy Tomasini. He was my partner for going up the hills and going here and going there. You know, he was the one that was with me the majority of time when I was back at the Sudbury Drive-In Theater, which, you know, doesn't exist anymore, but it fronts onto over a hill on Rinfret Street and LaSalle Boulevard facing the front, and Rinfret and all those streets at the back. We used to go up that highest point back up there with telescope, binoculars, and all our equipment and watch there every night, 1 o'clock till 3, 4 every morning, and then come home and go to bed. My wife threatened to divorce me more than once that year in 67 and also in 68. It's a good thing that they did start to taper off because I had a disease, and that was watching UFOs, and I guess I never would have stopped. But had they started to trickle off to one every, you know, 8 weeks, 7, 8 weeks, you know, in 68, as the summer wore on, then we go out, and it was a lot of fruitless nights after I had many, many sightings in 67, and quite a few from May, June, July on in 68. And then as the year wore on, it became less and less, because we weren't, as they call it, a hot spot on the map anymore. They were looking at something else. They must have mapped and studied Sudbury. To my opinion, they were studying our nickel veins and our water routes and everything in this district. Because for UFOs to come over every night, or almost every second night, June, July, August, September, right into October, and maybe probably all winter, but I wasn't one to put on a snowsuit and go stand out for 4 hours shivering in the cold. So I went out in the warm weather. But Sudbury was the spot. And according to the Air Force, yes, we are the hot spot. We are the place right now. The UFO flap. And I don't know what flap stands for yet. They said we're having a UFO flap. Before they had it in Florida, they had it in California, they had it in Australia. And when UFOs come almost on a nightly basis for day in, day out in one area, first it was Cape Real, then it was Worthington, Walden Township, over Sudbury, postal workers, we were even having them rode up in the Sudbury Star, eh? Postal worker in Cape Real sees UFO. So-and-so at 6 in the morning believes he's seen a UFO. This was what was happening in Sudbury in 67, 68. I went out a bit in 69 and lost interest, never in my heart, but only because they weren't there anymore. Then I would read in UFO magazines and books, a few which were canceled by the American government. There was the UFO Observer, which I think had 6 or 7 issues out, and I'd be waiting breathlessly for this issue on the newsstand, and it wasn't there, and it wasn't there. I only got 2 copies, I think. And then we heard that the American government said, we don't want this book out, you know. They canceled it out. They told the people, quit printing it up. Too close to the truth of what was happening around. They said public panic, and the book got out 1 or 2 times. Got off. They got printed. I never seen the first copies. I only seen the last couple. And then you couldn't get them. They were only $1.25 at the time. They were taken off the newsstand. They were too close to, and it mentioned a lot of the famous names that are now famous with you. You know, the people that are involved right up to this day. Mentioned Dr. So-and-so and this guy and that guy, and they were quite famous at the time. And then, of course, the government, I guess it was the American government, not it was American publication that had to come across the border. And I don't know if it's the Canadian government that said we won't allow this issue into Canada, or it just wasn't being printed anymore in the States. I don't know yet to this day. It was just canceled out, not because they needed money, because it belonged to a bigger network of magazines. It was just one of their publications, but it disappeared, and I was very, very disappointed. I would have liked to keep seeing this.